Lester, tell me about the time you served on a jury that hung a fella. Kirk, give a death penalty.
Electrocuted him.
Electrocuted him. All right, yeah. Go right ahead now.
Well, went to Hazard. There's 100 men. They come to Bowman and summons 100 men to go to Hazard on a jury. And I was chosen to be on the jury, trying a Combs boy for murder. And I tried to get off, told him I was kin to the Combses, and John Eversole was kin to me. There was a defending the boy. Charlie Becknell was helping the Commonwealth pick the jury, and Charlie accepted me, had the lawyer on that side, and John Eversole got up and said he knew about the connections of my mother-in-law through the Combses. So they accepted me on the jury, and this man had killed a taxi driver and stuffed him in a culvert, took his watch, his money, and his taxi cab, and got two sorry whores with him, and they went over to Virginia and got drunk and was involved in a car wreck, in an accident. And they put him in jail, and they put the two girls in one place and the two boys in another place. Troy Combs was the boy's name I sat on the jury to try. And when these girls began sobering up, they began telling about it. They thought they was put in jail for being drunk. That's what they're in for, you know. They thought they was put in for killing that man. The girls began telling about it, began telling this jailer. So he called back to Hazard and told them where to go and look in the culvert, see if they'd find that man, and they went and they found him. So Troy Combs, never got on the stand for his said. He never even swore for himself. And his mother got on the stand and swore that he was a bad boy, that he was awful bad boy. And his lawyer, when he's speaking to the jury, begged us to give him life in prison, not to take his life. But we give him life in prison. We give him the death penalty. And he was put to death later. And I was guarding a railroad bridge at Maloney, Kentucky, up above Vadeville one night. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the train come up, and the news butcher always throwed me off a paper, give me a paper there to read, a Lexington paper. And I seen a casket in there. I said, oh, who's dead? He said, a Combs boy that was put to death up at Hazard, Troy Combs. That was a little over a year later from the time, 2 years later from the time that I was on the jury tried him. And I seen his corpse go up on number 3 going up back to Hazard to bury him.
That's quite a coincidence, isn't it?
That happened.
Yeah. Used to be a lot of juries go from our counties over to Housie County to play them.
Yeah. They took a jury one time to Breathitt County, over to Jackson in Breathitt County, and we had to go around by
Hampton
and up that way, and it's way out of our way. And they give us mileage that way. And me and your daddy come back, and we come across the hill, and it was slow going, but we got back before a lot of the rest of them did. And they was calling around on a jury, and they called Elmer Long up, and they was trying some man for murder, and asked if he believed in capital punishment. Elmer Long says, no, Judge, I don't believe in punishing anybody. Says, stand aside, young man.
Oh, that's about as bad as the time he was at Fort Knox. And they discharged, sent him back home from summer camp.
Yeah, he had
had acute nostalgia.
Nostalgia, and George Long says, I know there's something bad wrong with that boy. Says, I knew there was something bad wrong with him. Said, see? Said, you see what's wrong with him.
Kirk, I run into something yesterday that you would enjoy. This old man I've been talking to up at Oneida started, we're doing veterinary type work when he's about 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about how he treated hollowtail and cow. And I said, damn veterinarian said, there ain't no such thing. What do you think about that?
Well, I'll tell you what. You see a veterinarian go to a cow, and the first thing he'll do, he'll get a little cow shit on his hands. And then he'll go to the cow's tail and wipe it off and feel for that hollowtail. And then he gives her a shot. The veterinarian gives her a shot for that hollowtail. And the old-fashioned way is, I had a cow sick and down one time. And Grant Becknell said, Lester, she's got hollowtail. He took a board and had a knife and put salt and soot out of the grate in that cow's tail and wrapped it back up, and then in 4 hours she was up and eating and back on her feet and got well and got all right. There's something to it, brother. I've seen two damn videos.
You don't think a veterinarian's telling the truth, huh?
Hell, a veterinarian don't want the hell he's talking about.
What is it?
I don't know what caused it.
You think they're just doing that to get a fee or what?
Well, now listen. They get this cow shit on their hands, and that's the first thing they're wiping it off on the cow's tail, and they're feeling of her tail, you know.
He's telling me yesterday how they treat the stemper and how they treat the stemper dog. Hold the dog and get a big wash.
What did this man say about the car?
Well, he said it's true, and he said he finally got some veterinary to admit it. But he asked him what he did for the stemper and the dog, and he said, well, they'd hold the dog, take a big ball of chicken feathers or any sort of feathers, and set them afire. And hold that under the dog's nose,
smoke
he'd
him.
Breathe the he'd breathe the fumes.
Yeah, and they'd do that for a horse with his temper.
Yeah, I didn't know it on a horse.
Yeah, I've seen Chess Wilson. We had one that had this temper we bought in Indiana.
You remember old Mike, that dog that Charlie Seals had?
Yeah.
That bird dog, wasn't he was down with this temper once, and I was maybe 12 years old, and he come one afternoon, and he said, son, let's go treat Mike for this temper. And we went back in the garden and dug up a big poke root. It's just like a big, long sweet potato.
And
he took it in and sliced it in with some grease and sugar in a skillet and fried it. Let the skillet cool and took it down and laid it down in front of old Mike, and old Mike let that skillet dry, and within 5 minutes he was on his feet, cured.
They something. They knew what they were doing.
But this old man had been...
I seen Chess Wilson. Chess Wilson's boy...
Chess Honey?
Chess Honey.
Where did he get that name?
Honey. He called everybody Honey. I don't know. But anyway, Chess Honey Wilson... His boy had caught the itch in school. And Chess got him a pneumatic and went out and dug some poke root. And he boiled that stuff down and made a strong solution out of it and put it on that boy. And it killed the itch on him, but goddamn it, all the hide come off him. He got it too strong and it set that boy afire. But it killed the itch. It got rid of the itch. He had to kill nearly anything else.
Like
killed
the barn. Didn't burn as bad as a log barn did it ever so.
Huh?
Didn't burn like a log barn.
No, I don't think so.
Huh?
It was that change of subject. A few days ago, Bernie Seals called me. He'd been in a halfway house here and left and was been gone 4 or 5 months. And he'd come back here and he called me and said, Lester, I said, I knew who it was. I said, I want you to come and take me over to Winchester. I'll pay you. I said, Bernie, I've got to go feed my wife. And he said, well, I'll wait. I said, just as quick as I do that, I've got to go for an eye appointment from a doctor. I said, I can't take you today. No way.
What's he doing down here?
Well, he worked in a halfway house as a dishwasher and paid him $75 a month. And he said he's going over to Winchester to work over there.
The question come up today, Lester. Is why did so damn many people from the hills move to Hamlin, Ohio? And I said it was a $5 work day and the job's like Ford and so forth.
Yeah.
When did you go up there and what did you drive?
I went up there in 1929.
How'd you get a job?
I just went in and got a job.
What kind of job did you get?
I got a job at Ford's.
$4.
What'd they do? $5. He started out $5 a day.
I started $5.
What?
I went to... I believe I was going to Dollar Air before I left there.
What kind of work did you do it for?
I was working on the wheel line. I worked in that.
What kind of wheels? What did you do?
That 1929 is when they made them wire wheels, you know, when they... I was inspecting wire wheels. I put them up on a table, and with one hand I'd turn and hit them with a hammer, and every time if one spoke broke out, well, you'd pitch him off in a pile itself, and the good ones you'd let go down the line.
Do a good job at it?
I don't know. They didn't keep me on it long. I come back there and I hadn't knocked them. I was knocking them out all, knocking the spokes out all of them. They said, what's the matter? I said, well, these spokes ain't no count. I said, they changed me to put me something else out. You're supposed to barely tap them, I think. But they said, this man had told me what to do. Said, hit them. And I'd be hitting them all right. I was knocking them out. This fact, when I knocked one or two out, I'd pitch him back in a pile and add a damn pile as big as this house.
Oh, me. There's a lot of people worked up there, wasn't there?
Oh,
right,
sure.
Yeah.
Me and Ed Brandberg and Andrew Brandberg and Hargis Peters and Luther Peters and Tom Brandberg and Henry Wynn and Caner Wynn and Fred Markham. I ain't named
Let's start the one the other day about Crook Smith.
I was on a jury that me and Charlie Seals,
Crook Smith was killed. Somebody shot his brains out with a double barrel shotgun.
Remember, that's that summer that that Clay Moore killed that man. Yeah. Remember, you and Charlie and I went
me
out
and,
on
a minute. Me and Charlie Seals, Charlie Seals summoned me on a jury inquest, the health inquest. What, let's see.
The coroner's inquest.
Coroner's inquest or something like that. Judge Seals. Me and your daddy both was on that. Went over there just after dark and we went and we drove one over there.
Found a justifiable homicide?
No, somebody killed him.
I say, but it's justifiable if they killed.
You
remember when they got him in court for shooting Willie Jett in the neck and he swore he thought he was shooting a groundhog?
Yeah, I sure did.
God, that was funny.
Yeah.
Oh, me. They killed two.
Jimmy Jett, you said.
Yeah,
Willie
yeah,
Jett.
Yeah,
Jimmy
they
Jett.
Killed.
Yeah, he shot him right there inside the head and shot him to the groundhog.
They killed two men over at Buckhorn night before.
Yeah,
that.
Georgia said to see that.
And wounded one. Shooting the hell out of places up there.
Yeah, I want you to take that. Most of that change the subject. I'm going to take that picture over and let Ruth Combs, she's the oldest in the family. And Ruth might know something about the age of daddy and mother on the
lawn. Did you look real good on the back to see if it's on?
There wasn't nothing on it.
Yeah, let me tape that record there for these kids. George Eversole, how old are you, George?
67.
When did you join the Navy?
1932.
And you served in the fleet most time, didn't you?
Yeah,
I was
19 years out of 22.
What did you serve on? What kind of vessels did you serve on?
Battleships, cruisers, destroyer.
Did you start right out after boot camp in
battleship?
On a battleship, what were you on?
The USS New York battleship.
How long were you on her? What were you doing?
About 6 years, to about 38.
38. Was that on international cruises and all that stuff around the world, all that there sort of stuff?
Well, we took midshipman cruise, went up to, over to Europe, went to Germany and Copenhagen, Denmark.
While you were over there, did you see a part of the German fleet by any chance?
No, I didn't take that much notice. We were in a German, we were in Kiel, Germany, but I didn't notice any of their ships. I wasn't that interested.
They ever tell you anything about the buildup of their fleets?
No, I never, there was nothing. Like I just, every time I was working in the ship's laundry and I was working awfully hard.
Yeah.
And when I got off work, I went right straight over and had me a bunch of German beer.
Bunch of German beer. Well, where were you when Pearl Harbor hit?
I was right in the middle of Pearl Harbor.
Well, tell me about it.
I was on the cruiser, Detroit. And
light or heavy cruiser?
That's a light cruiser. One of the older cruisers. I'd just gotten up and went down to the chow line, and I think it quietened down. I was where I'd eat. I come back and told my friend that if he wanted to go through the chow line, he better get up. And we were sleeping underneath the superstructure, a bunk room out there on the top deck. And I looked out, and there was a plane. And I seen it was a Japanese plane, and
how'd you identify it? Had you been trained? And
I seen the rising sun on the plane, and I could recognize that the Jap. I could recognize the nationality of the Jap.
He's that close?
It was that close. I could recognize the nationality. I knew it was a Jap.
Had you been in and out of Japan during the war? Had you been in and out of Japan with a fleet?
Not before the war.
What happened then? What did you think when you saw that guy?
Well, it was pretty scary. He dropped just 2 seconds, or 1 second after I seen him and recognized him, recognized it was a Jap plane, a Jap aviator. He dropped a torpedo right then, and the torpedo was going parallel. It was going to the stern towards the stern of our ship. And I didn't know enough about torpedoes to know just as soon as they hit the water, a gyro can make them turn, 90-degree turn. I didn't realize that, so I thought I was safe. But that thing did turn, and it hit the ship behind us. It hit the rear of the ship, which was Raleigh, same type cruiser. There were 57 men killed on that. And then we sat in the general quarters, and I was a phone talker, and I was underneath the superstructure decks, and they didn't secure us for a while. They said they wanted to keep, I was on broadside gun, the 6-inch, which we couldn't fire there in Pearl Harbor. And I stayed on the phone. They said for us to stay on our phones just to relay the word to the ship about different things. And I was the only one on the gun, just being the phone talker. Everybody else was cutting down awnings or on the anti-aircraft guns, passing ammunition or something like that. And we got underway. Our captain and executive officer both was ashore. But the head of department, lieutenant commander, got our ship underway. We must have had enough steam up, you know, for auxiliary purposes, enough steam up to get her underway. We got underway in 20 or 30 minutes. And we started around Port Island there, and some battleship was sunk or sinking right in the damn channel. So we turned around, went back around the way we come from, around Port Island, and went out. Went right on out the channel and went to sea. So I didn't really get, not that I wanted to, but I mean, I didn't have to view all the dead. No, yeah. I didn't go through much of that.
Y'all didn't get any real damage to your vessel then?
No, we got some machine gun strafes, one machine gun strafe across, and all.
Then where'd you go? You just take off?
We went to sea.
How far did you go to sea?
We went to sea and went around those islands for 3 days before we come in Wednesday. Yeah. And we dropped depth charges all the time. Not continuously, but just...
You got a sounding and you drop?
We dropped several depth charges during the 3 days. We had destroyers with us and other ships, but there wasn't damage. We come back in, it was pretty well cleared up then. I mean, all the dead was cleared up and all.
Kind of looked kind of bad at that time, didn't it?
Yeah,
we had just some old cruisers. We didn't have much modern Navy left there, didn't it?
They come over in three waves, and I was scared. And I reckon anybody else that knew how dangerous shape it was in would have been scared.
Well, George, the fleet just you weren't even starting to be combat ready then.
Well, no.
Had they had some notice of this or anything at all to be on ready on lookout?
Well, what it's all about, when we was in port there, we were supposed to be protected by the Army.
Yeah.
Radar. They had radar in those days.
And they picked up those planes, too.
Yeah, they picked the planes up. But they got mistaken some way and thought it was some friendly planes coming in.
As I remember, Lieutenant Lockwood was in charge of that radar, and he reported Japanese planes, and nobody paid a damn bit of attention to it.
Well, they reported there were some unidentified planes, and they finally determined that it was friendly planes.
There were some subs in that. Did Japs get some two-man subs in the harbor?
Yeah, they found some right in the harbor, one or two of them. I don't know just how many. I've seen them. The fact of the matter is they brought one to the United States and toured the country with it. Did you ever see it?
No, I never did see it.
What they call a two-man submarine, or one man they might even call it, one or two-man submarine.
Apparently they find one of those occasionally, even now.
They got, I don't know, where they found them, all over anywhere?
Yeah, I see. Didn't they sink one just outside the
They
Pearl
sunk.
Harbor?
I think they sunk or got one right inside the harbor that day. There's one on, I've seen one at a submarine base in Pearl Harbor.
Were our subs in the harbor too at the time? Everything was
I don't know. Yeah, if we did, we probably did have some in there at the time.
We didn't have any carriers really laying in there at that time, did we?
No, but there was one of our carriers, I don't know which one it was, Lexington, was supposed to have been the ship behind us, or two ships behind us. The Rawlings was behind us, and the next one was the old target ship, Utah, or was it Wyoming? Utah, it's been so long ago, I don't remember. Utah, Wyoming. And that's where one of our carriers was supposed to have been. If things had worked out and things had been on schedule, but it was delayed up around Midway, this carrier, which wasn't Lexington, I believe, was hauling troops. They was using it for a troop transport. And it was come in a day or two late.
What happened to Pearl after that attack? Did they just really go to getting ready or salvaging ships or what the hell did they do, or were they in a bit of confusion?
I still didn't.
Well, I say, after that initial attack, what the Navy, was the Navy utterly confused or did they begin to try to get reorganized in a hell of a hurry?
I don't know much about what they done. I know one thing, the way they caught us.
You followed them out, Daniel, pretty quick.
The way they caught us, they should have done, really, they done enough damage, but they should have done more than they did.
Whatever happened ultimately to the Detroit?
You mean since the war?
No, during the war, after that. What happened to them?
I stayed on the Detroit for 6 months after that, and we were doing convoy duty between San Francisco and Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. We had two destroyers with us, and we were the cruiser, and we were escorting a Liberty ship between. We made about 6 or 8 round trips, sir.
Did you have 4-stack destroyers or 2-stack, or the new classes?
Well, this is the old class that I was on.
Yeah, the first half day we were out of San Diego going over in May 42, we had 2 4-stack destroyers for half a day. So
the only way they classify destroyers, though, from heavy for light, is not their tonnage or any.
It's a gun size.
If she carries 6-inch guns, she's a light cruiser. Right. If she carries 8-inch, she's a heavy cruiser. But we made, I think, 6 or 7 round trips escorting merchant ships or Liberty ships. Well,
did you serve on any other battle wagons?
No.
Just whatever happened to New York?
She was sunk in the Bikini atomic bomb test.
Yeah, but she went through the war, didn't she?
Yeah. Well, no action, I don't think, no war.
Was you on the sub chaser a while?
Yeah, that was after the war. I mean, after Pearl Harbor, it was during the war, yes. I was all, that's where I done most of my Pacific duties on a sub chaser. I come after being on the Detroit for 6 months, after Pearl Harbor, I went to sub chaser training school in Miami, Florida for a couple of months. And then I was supposed to then we put new, supposed to be new construction in destroyers, and I knew a new destroyer would go right in the middle of action. And I was that all pepped up. I wanted to get right in some action. Because the way they caught us, I wanted to see if we could catch him in a bad shape. So I put in for this new construction in destroyers, knowing just as soon as we got outlined, we'd be right in the front, see? And instead of giving me, they gave me new construction, but instead of it being a destroyer, it was a subchaser, a smaller one.
That was the E-boat, wasn't it?
Well, it was a small subchaser. Yeah. They had PC boats and mm-hmm. subchasers. This is just a 110-foot wooden hull ship mm-hmm. with 2 diesel engines. Mm-hmm. Our complement was just 24 enlisted men and 3 officers. That's all the bunks they were on.
Sonar, radar, and all.
We had sonar, radar, and what else?
So you were gunning just outside harbors and so forth, looking.
We escorted ships from island to island. We was around Guadalcanal and Bougainville and Numia, New Caledonia. We went in there a few times, and New Guinea. And the Admiralty Islands and Ifadi. I forget, been so long ago, I forget the name of some of the islands. But anyway, we had all those islands. And our main duty was escorting ships from one island to the next. We'd run a zigzag course in front of the ships and escort them. But
You had ash cans, depth charges.
Yeah, we had depth charges. And millimeter, 40 millimeter guns. But our main depth charges was our main. But the sound gear, I stood sound gear and radar watches both. If fact of the matter is, I think Sad Nose radar watch is what made me have cataracts on
you
my
pick eye. Up, did you pick up whales or anything on the sonar?
Yeah, but it'll just last one time. I mean, if you pick up a whale, it might just, yeah, it would pick it up, all right, if it was just...
You couldn't track it.
Well, you'd get a bounce back, but it, and then the very next next ping, you wouldn't hear it.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear how sound gear works?
Yeah.
It sends that mm-hmm. out a ping, it'll go ping, and it'll ring, and then ping, and then if you get a contact, it'll go ping, pong, it'll come right back at you, and you can. I wasn't trained when General Quarter, when we got a contact, we sat at General Quarters. And everybody, we had regular trained men for that. In fact, in my head, before we went out there, we had training off San Diego to where the actual submarines would go down. And we tracked them and actually locate them that way. They had their training and they could tell pretty well which way a submarine was headed and their speed and everything. But our main weapon was depth charges. And Y guns. You ever hear Y guns?
Yep, I've seen the Y guns, yeah. They sent out two depth charges.
Yeah, I guess they shoot it to each side.
Yeah,
I forget.
She will shoot to each side.
Each side.
Or splay them out. Yeah.
Yeah, we had Y guns, a couple of them, or one. We
yeah, God, I spent a lot of time in and out of the fleet. See, we were in convoy time and time again, and then on a lot of the operations, I had the old USS Tennessee.
Tennessee.
The old Tennessee was used for us for close shore fire support. And the old Helena. Cruiser Helena.
Cruiser, yeah.
Yeah. And they like in Weetalk and Kwajalein and various places, we would land inside. We'd go into the lagoon and land from the inside. And we'd go right by their fortified islands. And then the old Tennessee would lay offshore and blast them with her shell. But at night, you'd see those red hot shells hit the sand and ricochet off and burst at sea. She'd have to back off and lob them in. The old Helena laid up there. She was a heavy, wasn't she?
I believe it.
I think she had 8-inch. Yeah, because I got caught twice in 8-inch cruiser fire.
We had
scared the hell out of
there. There was one night a mighty big loss for us. Off of Guadalcanal there, they had a battle, and we lost three heavy cruisers in one.
Is that the night the Vincennes and so forth?
Vincennes and Astora was two of them.
Yeah.
Vincennes, Astora, and I forget, I'm not sure.
Yeah, as a boy from Richmond, was midshipman, was one of the, I believe, exec maybe on the Vincennes. Dr. Doris, his son, he taught history here, was on the Vincennes.
We lost three in one night, or one battle, I put it that way. It might not have been one night.
It was in one night, yeah, because that's, you know, the first Marine Division was ashore. And
that was a mighty big loss.
And the Japanese fleet come running down through there. Tokyo Express, I guess.
It was right off Guadalcanal. Tulagi, you've been in there?
Yeah, Savo.
Guadalcanal is on one side, and then it's about 20 or 30
Florida
miles.
Florida Island.
What island?
Florida and Tulagi and Savo.
Yeah,
Savo
I've been to Guadalcanal over Tulagi too. But evidently you can go through there like a strait all the way through.
I think there's 169 ships sunk on the bottom of that during the war.
Around there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call it Iron Bottom Bay.
Good.
We were down there, there'd be Japanese, you know, the Maru, whatever Maru. And they would be beached, and there for a while, hell, they were landing Japanese troops, they were beaching Japanese transports inside of the Marines, and neither side could do much about it at the time. I think the real big breaks when it was Wisconsin, went down with radar one night, and at 40,000 yards, she sank a Japanese ship. And I think that was the beginning and the end of it.
Wisconsin. I never did see or hear of it. You sure that was the name of it?
I think it was Wisconsin.
That would be a battleship.
Yeah, it was a battleship. She had radar.
I never seen or heard of it. I never know
yeah,
we had one.
Yeah, there was
that
a Wisconsin.
Name.
Mm-hmm. Pretty sure that was
it. I've got this one ready for you over here. What do you want to get?
But that was kind of a scary, hairy day, huh?
Yeah, it was a scary day. I'm telling you that. It It was.
Where was Herman then? Was he?
Herman. Let's see.
Norfolk, Virginia.
He's probably Norfolk, Virginia, or Coca-Cola Canal Zone. I'm not sure. He was in an air station.
He saw a lot of.
Before the war, and when war broke out, Herman was a metalsmith.
Aviation metalsmith.
I believe I'll give you one of these trays that he made while he was in the Navy. He repaired on the body something of damaged planes,
mm-hmm.
And this airplane aluminum's what he made. He made them trays. Did you know that?
Well, he either made them or had them made, or that somebody was making them. Herman was kind of Herman never actually did much of his. He did administrative work more than he did actually the work.
Oh.
But he was his. When he first made his rate, it was called a third class aviation metalsmith. And then he went up, and I don't think he was ever.
Well, he was in music for a long time, wasn't he? Wasn't he a trumpeter for a bugler for a long time?
Well, he went to bugle master school.
Yeah.
And that's a 6-month school to where when you come out there, you're eligible. There's no such thing as, in those days, as third class bugle master.
Yeah.
And he was eligible after that school to be a second class bugle master, and the ratings were so slow and all.
Yeah, he
that he didn't get it, and he played in the band somewhere, but he was
all the class bugler.
George, did you ever hear a story or a rumor that we always heard, and I keep hearing pop every now and then, that before the day before Pearl Harbor, that a cruiser, I think it was the British cruiser, the Ajax, sank two Japanese destroyers or cruisers about 500 or 600 miles off the Panama Canal, the west coast.
I heard that.
We heard that they had sunk, and I read somewhere in the past few years something very similar to that. That these Japanese cruisers realized that something was up, and they just the Ajax was one of them. I guess later caught the Graf Spee out in Montevideo, wasn't it? When they sank that German cruiser down there, and they are supposed to have sunk two Japanese cruiser, 500 to 1,000 miles off Panama.
What big German battleship was that? The British
Bismarck. Yeah. He didn't realize that the war was over, and he torpedoed it. And there were 300 or 400 rescued. Okay, turn around now.
Bye.
Sang at a church where they handle rattlesnakes. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I've
heard. How many of you ever heard of a church that handles snakes?
Oh man, we got a mess of people.
Yeah. All right, I'll do it. We thought we had sung everywhere there is to sing. We had a chance one time to sing in Carnegie Hall. We sang in almost every country peaceful to our country around the world. And in almost every city, for instance, in Germany and Holland and Spain, we sang in every kind of church you could imagine and every kind of auditorium. And I thought that if nothing else, we had seen about all the crowds. And here not too long ago, we sang in a church up above, well, I won't say up above where, because then I'm going to start pinpointing the church and might get myself in a little Dutch. But up in the mountains of Kentucky, we sang in a church unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. This church had been writing us to come there and sing, and our agents had told us, when you get in 100 miles of that, go and sing. And we did. We pulled up in front of this church, and it was an old church. It was over 100 years old. It had never even been painted. It had 3 drop lights inside. We had to run drop cords a half a mile to get to our amps to plug up. When we pulled up in the yard, I told the children here, I said, we're going to have ourselves a time tonight. I just knew that old church is going to be full of spirit. And it was, honey. It was. We went in there. We sung about three songs. They were shouting all over that church. I've never seen so many people in one church shout. And in a little while, they shouted themselves right around in back of us. Three ladies and two men. Well, now, when we were hooking up, we saw some curtains or something laying over some boxes back there. We didn't pay any attention to it. Didn't know what was in there and didn't care. But in a little while, they came out around us with five of the biggest rattlesnakes I have ever laid my eyes on. I like to die. When the service was over, they told us that the biggest rattlesnake they had in that service was 5 feet long. Honey, the one they brought by me was 27 feet long. Let me say this. I'm not knocking these people. I promise you I'm not knocking them. I don't know if they're right or wrong, you know. I tell you, they claim that they read in the Bible where Moses had enough faith to take up the serpent. And some members of their congregation claim to have that much faith. And I'll tell you one thing I found out before I left that. They had a whole lot more faith than what I had. Now, this one woman stopped about 2 feet from where I was trying to pick and sing. I didn't even know what key I was in. She took that rattlesnake with a head as big as your fist and held it up and stuck it right down in her face and shouted in its ear, if a rattlesnake's got an ear. She wrapped that thing around her neck. She threw it down on the floor, kicked off her shoe, and put her bare foot on top of its head. When she threw that thing down on the floor, its tail missed my foot about that far. I done a little shot myself. And she thought I was in the spirit. But I saw right away that we had a house full of people and we didn't have but five rattlesnakes. And I want you folks to know one thing, they ain't a greedy bone in my body. I told them to give mine to Geraldine. These girls are scared of potato bugs. It hadn't even dawned on me that they was in the world. And all at once, I remembered them, and we had already backed up as far as we could back. And I looked around at Jerry, and she was the color of cotton. And I knew she was about 17 seconds from hitting the floor. She looked over there at me and said, what in the world are we going to do? And I said, just take it easy. Don't panic. I said, just look around and find out where the back door is. She said, I already looked and ain't none. Reckon where do they want one? As I went out the door, I told them where they could send my guitars and anchors. Now, if you ever get chance to go to church where they take up the sermon, I want you to go. Sit on the back row, but go. I stood around and I mixed and mingled with these people after service was over. I just couldn't leave. Man, I wanted to talk to these people. I wanted to hear more about them. I was interested in anybody got that kind of faith or whatever it is it takes to pick one of them up. I mean, a frog I can see. And I was talking with a preacher back in the back of the church, and I was telling him, I said, well, I ain't no way I can knock it. He said, I hope you don't disapprove. And I said, ain't no way I can knock it, man. I said, ain't no way I can pick that thing up. I've seen them now, and I couldn't touch one of them. And this lady walked up to me. She said, Brother Wendy, you mean to tell me if the Lord commanded you to take up the serpent, you wouldn't take him up? I said, yes, ma'am, I surely would. But he didn't, and I ain't.
Yeah, that's all I get.